May it please the court. I'd like to discuss three issues today where we believe the trial court abused its discretion in its order modifying child support of January 11, 2012, mid-pro to December 19, 2011. The three issues are these. By including rental income in appellant mother's income for purposes of calculating child support, by including gift income in mother's income for purposes of calculating child support, and by declining to award attorney's fees to mother pursuant to CRS section 1410.119. Regarding the rental income that was included in mother's income for purposes of calculating child support, we believe there's two problems with the trial court's order, and they are these. That the both parties, there's record support, received rental contributions from live-in significant others. The problem was the contribution received by father was not treated the same as the contribution received by mother.
Are you arguing what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander? Or are you saying there weren't facts to support the judge's findings?
Essentially both. I believe that there were, I think the there were facts to support that father was receiving rental income from his living girlfriend.
So that's a factual finding that the court makes, and don't we only review that for error?
I think that's a factual finding that the court failed to make. That's why I believe there is an abuse of discretion.
Right.
And I'll follow up with that. The trial court judge, in not including any rental income to father, stated that I included no rental income to father, and the reason I did that was because there was one check prior to the motion to modify that indicated that rent was being paid. The trial court judge goes on to state, I also considered the notation about the check, which the court indicated that it was being paid tongue-in-cheek. The father, in his answer brief, agrees with the trial court judge, stating that there's no indication that father regularly received this rental income, but there was. And that was trial exhibit 23 by the mother, which was a loan application. And the loan application was made by the father and his live-in girlfriend as a co-applicant in August of 2011, well after the motion to modify child support was filed. On that loan application, Ms. Ellard, the father's live-in girlfriend, stated that she paid $800 per month.
Did she testify at the hearing?
She did not testify. It was on a loan application admitted as a trial exhibit. It was signed by Ms. Ellard, and the address to which she paid rent was listed as the father's address.
So aren't you asking us to find that the judge was clearly erroneous in not including that purported rent payment? Isn't that the standard that we have to apply?
I believe the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and yes, whether he was clearly erroneous.
Well, that's different. Abuse of discretion is not the same as clearly erroneous. What's the basis for saying this seems like a fact finding, usually tested by the clearly erroneous standard?
I believe that the standard of review is the abuse of discretion applied to this particular issue. Going on.
Well, pardon me, counsel, if I may. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that there are no facts in the record to support the trial court's decision?
I'm saying that the court abused its discretion by not considering all the facts that are in the record.
But so you do agree that there are some facts in the record that could support the trial court's decision, but your position is that there were other facts that you think the court ignored?
That's correct. I think the greater weight of the evidence was ignored by the court.
Counsel, on this question of rental income, the claim of error is that the rental income should not have been attributed to her. So how does the trial court's alleged failure to attribute rental income to him matter?
Well, I think it needed to be addressed because the trial court judge gave a reason for not including it to father and then gave a reason for including it to mother. And so I think in the record there are reasons why it should have been included to father and there are reasons why it should have been excluded to mother. So I think the question should have been addressed, but I think the court is correct in saying what we're arguing in our opening brief is that we'd like it excluded from both parties' income. And the reason is this, that under INRI, the marriage of Nemo, 891 Pacific 2nd, 1002 Colorado, 1995, amounts paid by third parties for expenses such as mortgage payments, car, home repairs, insurance, utilities, etc., should be excluded from one's income for purposes of calculating child support. There is record support that mother used the contribution from her live-in boyfriend to defray the cost of her mortgage and HOA.
And did she reduce the mortgage expense on her financial affidavit showing that?
She did not.
So she's kind of double counting then, isn't she? I mean, if she uses it to defray the expense, shouldn't she have reduced the expense on the financial affidavit?
What she did, Your Honor, is she included it, the full amount as income, and then she also took a deduction for the full amount of the mortgage, so it was not double counted because she didn't take the net amount.
Exactly, she didn't take the net amount. If she had used $800 from the living boyfriend to reduce her expenses, then she should have, the expenses should have been reduced as well.
Well, and perhaps I'm not understanding the court's question, but on her sworn financial statement, she listed that $800 in full as income to her.
Right.
So, which the judge found was income to her.
Right.
And I believe that that was a misnomer or an oversight on the mother's part because she had no net rental income. So, to answer the court's question, it should not have been listed as income. It should have been listed as a offset against the mortgage payment, and it was not.
But that's how she listed it in the amended affidavit that she filed on December 17th.
Right.
Three hours after she filed an earlier affidavit where she did try to offset it, right? So she withdrew the one where she offset it. She filed one where she didn't offset it.
That's correct.
And that's what Judge Russell found, I think.
He did. He found that because she listed it on her sworn financial statement, she admitted that she was receiving the rental income. What I'm asking the court to consider today, and this is the second piece of the rental income argument, is that in effect, the sworn financial statement asks you to list net rental income. There was no net rental income after applied to the mortgage and HOA costs. Her mortgage and HOA costs were $1,638 per month, and she received $800 per month from her live-in boyfriend. So under CRS Section 1410.115, Section 583B, only the net rental income should be considered for purposes of calculating child support, and it wasn't in this particular case.
Was that argument made to the district court?
It was, I believe it was made in the motion, the post-trial relief motion, Your Honor, but I'm not entirely sure. Regarding the gift income, the trial court included in mother's income for purposes of calculating child support $900 per month as gift income received from her mother, Ms. Walker. The gift income may be included for purposes of calculating child support in income if it's regularly received from a dependable source. The testimony in this case was, number one, that the funds received from Ms. Walker were loans and not gifts, that the amount of the funds was supported by promissory notes executed by the mother to Ms. Walker, and that the funds borrowed from Ms. Walker, the date of those funds coincided almost exactly when mother's contractual maintenance terminated, and she testified that she had to borrow those funds to continue to maintain the standard of living for the children. The amounts, at least in 2010, and the time received regarding those funds also varied. So it's the mother's contention that number one, the funds were loans that she intends to pay back, and she testified to that effect, and two, that they were not regularly received from a dependable source. I think the court needs to consider, and the trial court overlooked this, that what it in effect did was obligate Ms. Walker to continue to contribute that $900 per month, or these children's needs are going to be met because it was included in mother's income.
Let me just, the mother testified though that her mother gives her checks of $900 a month. She answered yes, every month, yes, no matter what. On a regular basis, yes, recurs every month, yes. And this is her testimony out of the transcript. Certainly Based on that, could not Judge Russell have found that this was a regular recurring $900 monthly payment? At least in 2011, I understand in 2010 there may have been some notes, but in 2011 there were no notes, were there?
I think it's fair to say he could have found that. I think he should have considered the fact that Mother testified that there were loans, there were promissory notes evidencing the loans, and that she couldn't make it without borrowing the money from her mother.
How do we know that he did not consider that?
All I can say is the record, there's no statement to that effect.
But don't we assume that courts pay attention to everything that goes through? And we have no rule that says in entering orders that a court must state each and every single item that the court has heard upon which the court is relying, do we?
That's true, Your Honor. And I would just submit that in calculating income for purposes of child support and in characterizing gift income and including it in mother's income, there should have been findings that the income was regularly received from a dependable source and frankly that it was likely to continue to be received. And I don't think that finding was made. Finally, on the issue of attorney's fees, we believe that the court abused its discretion in declining to award mother attorney fees. And just a little bit by way of background, mother was represented throughout this case by her stepfather, Mr. Walker. Mr. Walker indicated, and it came out in mother's testimony, that he cut his fees in half to represent mother, and that he was requesting reimbursement only for his office staff and associates that did the majority of the work on this case, including myself. That mother had been awarded fees in this case incident to temporary orders by the magistrate. The magistrate cited Henry the Marriage of Swink, which likened stepfather's representation of mother to pro bono representation where an award of attorney's fees may be made. The trial court's only finding in this regard was that the court is going to order that each party pay their own attorney fees and costs, and he states, I have considered the provisions of section 1410.119. 1410.119 requires the court to consider the financial resources available to the parties. What we had in this case, and what is not clear that the court considered, is that the father had over $200,000 in retirement assets available to him that he used for his expenses, that he had two homes, one of which was an income-producing property, that he had the ability to buy and sell stock, and that his income was two times what mother's income was, at least, and that even includes the rental contribution from her boyfriend and the $900 per month gift income. It's also telling that the trial court did reallocate the CFI fees in this case, and the court reallocated those fees to require father to pay a greater percentage. So while there's the legal standards under 1410.116.5 and 1410.119 are different, there is an acknowledgement of a disparity there and a consideration of the equity where clearly the trial court, at least on one level, found that the father had the ability to pay more of the expert fees, and we believe that should have carried over to the an award of attorney's fees to mother. I have a minute 28 left. I'll reserve that for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Greg Ortiz, registration number 32690, appearing on behalf of the appellee, Kevin Davis. And as counsel pointed out, there's three issues. Two of those are combined. One is the rental income, the other is the monetary gift income, which goes towards the child support, the third being the attorney's fees. I'll touch on all three of those issues. In regards to the rental income, Your Honor, the opening brief relies upon NEMO and talks of how that rental income is used to offset a mortgage, and they try to analogize and use that within NEMO. Here's the problem with that analogy that's being used. NEMO has a two-part test to it. It does say And you know that in line of court is a discovery issue, whether this is discoverable information for purposes of child support. So in looking at that, it says that if this is income or monetary gifts that are being provided from one spouse to the other spouse directly, that's income. Because income for child support purposes comes from any source. However, if there is income or payments from a spouse that go to third parties, that's treated as something entirely different. So in NEMO, what happens is that they pay, that Mr. Senior pays the mortgage, utilities, and so on and so forth. And the court says that's incidental to a marriage. So as being incidental to a marriage, yes, Ms. Senior gets benefit from that. However, that's not income to her. That's incidental to the marriage. However, if he were providing direct monetary gifts to her, that would be considered income.
So in this case, if the so-called live-in boyfriend had written the $800 check to the mortgage company instead of to the wife, it would be the same situation as NEMO, right?
No, I disagree with that. And that's the second part to the test. So first, it has to be paid to a third party. And then second, the test is it has to be incidental to a marriage. So, for example, if the live-in boyfriend were paying $800 directly to the mortgage company, and another roommate were paying $800 directly to Ms. Davis, two different, entirely different items, okay? But in one particular case, what the living boyfriend is doing is he's paying money to her benefit because she's taking, this is her mortgage, her asset that she's paying for on a regular basis. It's not that he is paying that to a third party for his own benefit as well. He's paying that to accommodate one of her expenses. However, if there was another roommate that was paying her directly $800 that was going into her bank account that she was then turning around and using to pay children's expenses, groceries bills, things like that, that would be rental income. Well, that's no different because you're throwing, if you're not married, that whether you pay it directly to the third party or you pay it directly to her, there is no difference. But if you are married, now you're receiving some benefit from that because when they file that joint tax return at the end of the year, they're both receiving the benefit of that interest deduction. Under this scenario that I provided you, she's going to receive that interest deduction. So you can't hide it just by going to a third party. You also need to be married as well in order for that to occur. On top of that, Ms. Davis filed a sworn financial affidavit, as the court pointed out, at the last hour before trial. Within that financial affidavit, she acknowledged that she was receiving $800 a month in rental income. In addition to that, the trial court asked her, are you receiving $800 a month in rental income? Yes, I am. Are you receiving $900 a month in gift income from your mother? Yes, I am. She admitted on the stand, on the record, that she was receiving the rental income and the gift income from her mother. The evidence shows and the record shows that in her bank account, it was shown that she was receiving that $800 each month from her significant other.
Let me ask you a question about the gift income, if I may. She did testify she received it, if I have the years right, in 2010, and I think she produced notes, promissory notes. The judge didn't give much weight to that. She apparently received $900 a month also in 2011, and the judge included that in her income. But the judge entered his order in January of 2012, and yet he counted that $900 as if it was going to continue, as I read his order, throughout all of 2012. Of course, there was no actual record of that. What's the basis for the judge counting the $900 for the calculation of child support for 2012 going forward from the day when there was no testimony about, date after there was no testimony or no evidence of the gifts being made?
Well, it's twofold, Your Honor. So first of all, the $900 that was received regularly after that, Ms. Davis admitted on the witness stand that $10,000 was a gift. At the time, let's get there. She testified that she was receiving, as the court pointed out, $900 thereafter from her mother. She did not ever testify that was to end. And so that $900 is presumed to continue and be ongoing. there is not, that loan documents that were provided were inconsistent in two manners. One is, one of those documents was 3 years after the amounts had been received. And then secondly, the amounts received did not add up to the loan documents over that time period. So for the year 2011, she received $900 a month. That would have been $10,800. The loan documents were inconsistent with those type of amounts.
Well, when a person's regularly employed, I can understand why the court would assume salary would continue, but gifts at $900 a month might not continue. And I guess I'm trying to figure out what the basis was for the trial court's finding that, again, not 2010, not 2011, I understand that, they were actually received, but how could he decide that going forward, the 2012, the loans would continue in 2012?
I would not be able to speculate on why the court would do that, although I will say is that the gift tax in 2011 and 2012 was $11,000, and $900 a month were right underneath that gift tax threshold for the IRS code. So I don't know why the court did that. The court didn't put that on the record, but I think that there's a reasonable presumption there.
Assuming that the mother discontinued the gifts in 2012, I would take it the wife could go back and try to get child support readjusted for 2012.
She could.
That's probably 10%.
If it's not there, that would be the case. I would agree with that.
Okay.
Mr. Ortiz, I'd like to ask you a question about father's rental income. Counsel has pointed out this loan application, and it was also pointed out in the opening brief. I didn't see any direct response to that particular document in the opening brief. I didn't see any response to that in your answer brief. How do you, I mean, that seems like some kind of an admission. Father signs the loan application as well. It's a joint application. Why isn't that an admission from him that he's receiving $800 or he's receiving rental income from his living girlfriend?
Because that same loan documentation also said that they were married. And that fits right into that NEMA analysis that I provided to you a moment ago. That if you're married, it's something different. It should be treated as something
different. So the loan application, he represents that he's married. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
And that was not true.
The record was not clear about that, and the judge put that in his order, that the credibility of that piece of the testimony was unclear. I don't know that there was a common law marriage. I don't know if there was a formal marriage. I don't know how that transpired, and the record did not ever clarify that point specifically. Although it was an issue of credibility that the court addressed.
All right, but it seems a little bit incongruous for the court to find the father not credible on the issue and then say, "But I'm not going to decide that he is in fact receiving rental income."
And I understand that, Your Honor. However, what the court also went on to say is that there was no other evidence provided. So there was one check received or one payment received prior to the filing of the motion, and no other record of any payment received after that. Even the month between that first check and the time the motion was filed, there was no record of any sort of a payment. The court went on to say that, look, counsel, meaning Ms. Davis's counsel, if there was something out there to show me that this was regular and ongoing rental income, I'm confident that you would have showed this to me. And pointed out that there isn't any other evidence other than that one payment prior to the marriage and the loan documentation signed by a witness that wasn't presented before the court.
Pardon me, Mr. Ortiz, I'd like to explore this just one step further. If there is some issue about the credibility of that document, and apparently the court indicated that there was some issue about the credibility of that document, which way does that cut? Does that cut in favor of saying, well, we're going to disregard the document? Or does that cut in favor of saying, well, we're going to take a look at the document and construe it in favor of wife?
I don't think that document has any probative value in this particular case because if the credibility is a question, you have to look beyond those facts and look at the other factors. And that's where the court came back and said, I was provided no other evidence that there was rental income during the time period in which this motion was filed.
Did the husband provide all of his bank records for the year?
Yes, he did.
And the wife and the bank records found one check for rent that had that notation on it, right?
Right, and that was a couple months prior to the filing of the motion.
No other checks were found that were like that?
Correct.
And I take it there were no cash deposits shown to the court that may have been rent paid by cash?
Correct. In addition to that, Mr. Davis filed a sworn financial affidavit with the court. And so the consistency between his bank statements and his sworn financial affidavit was not questioned by cross-examination through the court. And I'd like to touch on the issue of the attorney's fees. First of all, I ask that the court affirm both the trial court on both the issue of the rental income and the gift income. In regards to the attorney's fees, the question that's being brought before the court is whether the court considered all the factors in awarding or ordering for the parties to pay their own attorney's fees and costs. The court did consider those factors. The record shows that the court thought about the fact that some of the income that is being used for child support purposes is the result of the appellant not refinancing the marital home. The record is clear that Mr. Davis purchased a home that was close to within the children's school zone, allowed the children to walk back and forth between the two parents' homes, and was commended by the CFI in her recommendations for a 50-50 parenting time. So he made that purchase to the benefit of the children, but he had withdrawal funds from his inherited IRA to do so. So it's not as if he took that income and then had that income available for other purposes. He did that for the benefit of his children. The court considered that as one of its factors and said, had Ms. Davis refinanced the home as she should have pursuant to the permanent orders, then he would not have had to take out the additional money or the extra money that he took out on the purchase of that second home. That is one factor that was considered by the court.
Who lived in the second home?
He turned it into a rental income. So he at the time of permanent orders, he had a condominium. Mm-hmm. He lived in that condominium. He then, after post-decree, he purchased a home that he moved into with the children.
So they'd be closer to the school.
So they'd be closer to the school and mom's home. Okay, thank you. In addition to that, the argument is made that the court reallocated the CFI's fees. Well, the court didn't reallocate the CFI's fees. The court ordered the CFI fees in the very beginning when the CFI was appointed. And the court did that based upon the sworn financial affidavits that were filed with the court at the beginning of this case. That income reported by Ms. Davis did not include rental income, did not include gift income. It was just based upon those wages reported by Ms. Davis. The court continued that order, and that doesn't mean that the court said, okay, you have a disparity of income. The court considered all factors in determining the financial circumstances of the parties. The court says, yes, he has this additional income that he took from an IRA, but at the same time, because I'm making him pay more of the CFI fees than really he should be paying, that's a factor to be considered, and that's part of your attorney's fees and costs, or if I were to be provided one. That's my interpretation of one of those court's factors. Finally, the third and final factor considered by the court, it was throughout the record, is that Ms. Davis was represented by her stepfather. There's testimony that was the case also at permanent orders, and there was also testimony that those attorney's fees were paid directly to Ms. Davis by Mr. Davis at permanent orders, but not in turn paid to Mr. Tim Walker, her stepfather, after that award was provided. So the court took the totality of the circumstances. If you look at all that, it doesn't mean that there's a formula. It just means that you take everything in consideration, and all the considerations under 1410.119, the court did consider the factors. Ask that the court again affirm the trial court in regards to the award of attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ortiz. Ms. Wright, I believe you have about a minute and a half.
Thank you. I would just like to address two issues very briefly, and the first one being the two-part test in NIMO. In review of the answer brief submitted by the father, the two-part test is not addressed. The only reason father cites regarding the rental income is that mother admitted she was receiving rental income, so it was included, and father testified he was not receiving rental income, and there was no other evidence, so it was excluded. And today there's a statement that this two-part test was applied to father, and that's why the rental income was excluded from father. But that's not in the record. In fact, in NIMO, the parties in that particular case were married, but I don't believe that the contributions by third parties is limited to married individuals. I don't think the Menlo Court made that limitation. And that's why we at least suggested this court to consider applying it to the parties in this particular case, both of whom were not married at the time of this modification hearing. With respect to the attorney's fees and costs, what I'm hearing from father's arguments that mother should be punished because she didn't refinance on time and wasn't able to do so. And that's certainly not the statutory basis for an award of attorney's fees. So in conclusion, I'd like the court to consider the issues addressed in the opening brief and remand the case for consideration of those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case will stand submitted and we will issue a decision in due course.